He's got old equipment there, and he's been doing that for the last 20 years. He's got test equipment. You have a QSO with him ahead of time to make sure he brings something with him that goes up to 5.8 gigs, and he's got a couple of them, that he can make the measurement for him right at that flea market. Or he can make an arrangement with Andy and eventually talk him into making that measurement at his house by bringing him a pizza pie, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Bill, K2IW. That's the first guy I can think of.
The pizza arrangement might work out. Also, I think I'm going to be meeting up with Jesse sometime Wednesday, and I was wondering if you might be interested in meeting on the air at around 9 p.m. Wednesday to continue Cloverleaf discussions, AC2IS.
I got some idea what I'm going to be involved in the next week, and not likely that I got the time to do that, Bill. I put in 4 hours on the TechNet each week, and I'm always getting letters from people who say, please do all of this written free consulting for me by internet, writing letters, and people are always making extra requests. It's flattering to make the request. I've got to cut it off somewhere, if you know what I mean. There are other people. If he was willing to travel all the way to Staten Island, John is down to his last 45 or 50 pieces of test equipment that are ready to be turned on to make the kind of measurements that he would like to make. So there are guys out there who've got the equipment that can measure the performance of a 5.8 gig cloverleaf antenna. Just a matter of finding them. Okay, let's go back to the mailbag. And John, sorry we've got this big delay, a big sidetrack. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, good questions. That is very interesting subject. All right, let me drop up on to the next question.
There's only 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. Back to you, John.
Okay, Dick, have a young amateur who has a, he's recently purchased a couple of radios, and he's testing the S-meters. Some are digital displays, some are analog displays, and he's looking at the analog displays, and he noticed something very strange. He knows that each S unit is approximately 6 dB letter drop. And he also noticed that on the upper, if it's 20 over and 30 over, and he applies a 6 dB waiter, he notices it drops approximately one S unit. But as it goes below, where he's at like 7 S units, notices it goes to 9 dB of attenuation to drop it. And the lower he goes, the more it takes. When he gets down to 2 or 3, it takes 12 dB of attenuation to drop it an S unit. He'd like to know what's going on. Is it his imagination or not? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
The whole idea of the S meter on a radio, the signal strength indicator, it's a relative device. Almost every single one of the rigs, whenever I brought home a well-calibrated signal generator, and I run the signal generator up and down in amplitude, and look at the S meter, it is always disappointing. I found some very high quality rigs. I don't care if it's named Collins or Drake or Kenwood or Yaesu or ICOM. No matter what rig it is, you run the signal strength meter up and down with a well-calibrated signal source, you're going to be disappointed. They are terrifically nonlinear. They tend to compress a lot at strong signals. They tend to stretch a whole lot for weak signals. And that's exactly what you've experienced. And sometimes they stretch in the other direction, by the way. Sometimes you lower the signal by 2 dB, and it'll change a whole S unit. So the manufacturer knows it's a relative indicating device. He wants to make sure that the S meter is sensitive enough. Let me drop it. The manufacturer knows that that particular model number and brand name of rig is going to acquire a bad reputation if the S meter is scotch. As such, they make sure the S meter reads, if anything, it reads high. If you tell a guy that's really weak that he's giving you an S8 signal, he's going to be happy. You tell him he's giving you an S1/2 S unit signal, he's going to be unhappy. And the manufacturer wants people to be happy. So if anything, they make the to make the S-meter the opposite of scotch. They make it very liberal. And so I don't think there's a rink in the world that has an S-meter that's well calibrated across the whole amplitude range. If you think about that amplitude range, 60 dB over S9, you know what that means. S9 is 50 microvolts. You go 6 dB down for each S unit, so 9 times 6 is 54, 54 plus 60. We've got 94 decibels of dynamic range in theory. Let me drop.
Good job.
You've got something like 94 dB of requested dynamic range of that signal strength meter. Can one simple feedback path to an automatic gain control circuit of a receiver have 94 dB of dynamic range and stay linear across that whole range? Believe that, and you and I are going to sell somebody another piece of that Verrazano bridge that's in front of your property there, John. Not a chance. If you had to design a rig which has a really linear S-meter, the way I would do it is to go out to the Plessy company, a British company, that makes very high-quality logarithmic IF integrated circuit chips. Each chip covers 10 dB. Put 10 of those chips together, properly wired, you have 100 dB of dynamic range capability. By way of that extra circuit, you could make an extremely linear signal strength meter. Oh, by the way, it would only cost you $100 with the hardware to do it. No manufacturer of a receiver is going to do that. So the technology is there to do it. Nobody's willing to invest the dollars for it, and only an extremely small percentage of the ham radio purchasers of the rig really get a hold of a calibrated system of step attenuators or signal generators where they can test the S-meter. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I've got a quickie question for John on that S-meter.
Go ahead, Paul. I mean, that sounds like Barry.
Yeah. Okay, John, I don't want to take up the net, but you have a number of Kenwood 2000s. I've had two. I'm on my second one now, and I like it very much. I find the S-meter is a real curiosity in that thing. It never reads high. Do you find US to be the same way in 2MB?
KC2WGB. Barry, from what I understand, the accuracy of the S-meter depended on the preamp. Now, from what I understand, from what I've read, if you're going to read that S-meter, the preamp has to be on. Otherwise, it attenuates what you're reading. And it seems to be all four of them behave the same way. And that's what I understand. Now, I don't know if you read that and interpreted the same way I did. What do you think?
I've never done anything about it. That's why I asked you. I find I have to leave the preamp on or the S-meter reads next to nothing. And you get the feeling that the radio is not very sensitive. It's quite sensitive. But the S-meter is really stingy. That's what I found. I think you found the same thing.
By the way, Barry, by way of the man who I'm acting for, who is a silent key, and I'm handling his estate, there is another Kenwood 2000 sitting there ready to go, and it's equipped with Cold 96, 432, 2 meters, 6 meters. I think it's even got 220 in it. Anybody interested? Give me a call letter. Give me a shout. K2RIW listening.
I am. The price is right.
220? I didn't know you could get that in it.
I know it's got a tag on the back with a great big listing, and I wrote it down on one of my emails, emails that I sent to somebody. So if I go back to the email, I'll find you the exact frequencies. But it's sitting ready to roll, and I think it's going to be approximately the same price as the one you bought before, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, is that with the Kenwood power supply unit also?
That's big 10-4, good buddy.
Okay. Yep. If you could send me the frequency list, I don't think it has 200, but it has the 1200. Now, some of them have the 200 feature, 200 megs, or 900, so I don't know if it has either one of those.
I'm going to write you an email in which I'll tell you what frequencies are on its label. Get a label in the back as to what has been installed. And so we'll make you a deal. And there's a couple of other parts, so it's ready to roll. Let's see if Barry wants to make any comments on all of the above. N2 moon mounts, K2LAW. Just think, that guy in Staten Island is going to have his fifth rig of that type. You got it, Barry.
I'm going to take up the whole of that with this, but I'm interested in that also. If it has 900 or 220 in it, I'd like to know if I could get that. But I didn't even know that was available. I just found out now. So evidently there's something going on I know nothing about. Very interested in that. And Dick, you know what I'm looking for. If you ever come across one of those things, call me up at 3 in the morning and 2MB.
Yeah, you and I know that there is a particular person who received it from our buddy. And there's something mysterious that went on there. I got to do a little bit more checking. Okay, let's go to the... I'll be mailing you and John an email about this information. John, go to the next email, the next mailbag, KQRIW.
Okay, if Barry needs it, he probably needs it more than I do. But whatever works, that'll be fine. I'll read the email. All right, let me let a drop a coin to the next question. This is a young scientist we had here, and he's got an interesting question. KC2WGB. Kind of a strange question, Dick, but imagine a cylinder, a sealed cylinder, that's whatever size, let's say it's 10 feet long and 5 foot in diameter. And inside of this cylinder, we place something that's explosive, let's say dynamite, and when dynamite detonates, it pregas. Rapid expansion of gas is what's doing the damage. Well, his question is this. If he exploded a stick of dynamite within that cylinder, and it was capable of handling the explosion, it would have a pressure buildup. Now he wants to know, would the maximum pressure be maintained, or would the pressure reduce? What would happen to that pressure? Let's say it reached 1,500 pounds per square foot, or the square inch, and would it maintain that pressure, or would it slowly, for some reason, reduce after settling? What do you think, Dick? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And where would it go?
Yeah, I think I've got an answer to this one. You're starting off with this, in his case, 5 foot diameter, very strong steel pipe, 10 feet long. It has, I don't know the exact number, we can calculate it. Maybe it's got 5 pounds of air inside of it. Air's got a certain number of pounds per cubic foot. I have to have that number on the top of my head. It's got a certain number of pounds of steel. And assume it's got a very thick steel. And when you bring a stick of dynamite in there, I'm going to make a guess that the stick of dynamite is roughly 1 pound. You've added an extra pound of stuff. So you got a pound of dynamite, and you got 5 pounds of air, and you've got, I'm going to pick a number, 200 pounds of steel pipe. That's what you're starting off with. And assuming that the pipe is strong enough to tolerate the impact of that pressure wave that the dynamite creates when it goes off, that pressure wave is because the chemical reaction of the dynamite creates a huge amount of heat in microseconds. And that heat in microseconds is expanding the air nearby. Expansion of the air is a major component of the shockwave of any pyrotechnics. You explode an atomic bomb on the Earth, it issues a tremendous number of very high velocity neutrons, which are impacting the air molecules and heating them up like crazy, and the extra temperature of millions and billions of degrees creates an expansion of the air that creates a shockwave. You explode that nuclear bomb in the vacuum of space alongside of your comet or asteroid that's heading for the Earth. Let me drop. And you're going to be very disappointed. You're not going to get a great big hot shockwave in a mushroom cloud. Those high velocity neutrons coming out of that nuclear bomb alongside of your comet are going to overheat the surface of the comet nearby. It's going to do a little bit of damage, but the majority of what you think is the real impact of an atomic bomb. It's because of the air around it, and in space you ain't got that air. So you start off with a certain amount of massive materials in the beginning. After the extremely high temperature shockwave subsides, and you wait long enough for everything inside that steel container to cool off, you're going to go right back to the exact same pressure you had before. It went nowhere. You created an extremely high temperature for a brief period of time, and if you can sustain that, it'll go back to normal air pressure when everything cools off. Very similar to what happens, let me drop this. You take a candle, and you put it into a fish tank and close the cover, and let the candle burn down. And you measure all the stuff before and after. You come up with the exact same weight. You've converted some of it into soot, but, I mean, the material that's in this tank, matter cannot be created or destroyed. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. Just changed in form. Temporarily, you've got a lot of heat, you've got a lot of shock wave. You wait long enough to cool off, everything will go back to a whole bunch of pieces of stuff inside your tank, but you'll have the exact same air pressure you had when you began with. That's my belief. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the tech mask. Comment?
Okay, Dick. What he was thinking is when it converts in that explosion, it produces gas, which would be in excess. I believe that's what he's talking about also, but okay, sounds good. We'll go to comment.
The majority of that shock wave is due to the heat. Yes, there's a little bit of extra gas. And maybe when everything cools off, instead of 14.7 pounds per square inch, it's going to be 14.9 pounds per square inch inside the tank. Because some of the solid materials that went into the dynamite became gaseous. But the total volume of that gas, the total number of pounds of stuff that he started off with, and the total number of pounds of stuff he ends up with are the exact same number of pounds of stuff. Who's the person with comment? Please give us your full call letters and name. K2RIW in the tech man. My name is Dick.
Comment for Barry first, Dick.
Okay, go ahead, Barry.
Barry, Richie would like you to pick up the phone.
No. By the way, this is a very interesting night tonight. I'm really enjoying it. Back in air control at 2MB.
Barry, Richie would like you to pick up the phone.
There's a man with good taste. Who's the other person who want to make a comment?
Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa. Name is John, and that was my business for a number of years. When the detonation occurs, there's definitely going to be a dramatic and acute hyperbaric change. As soon as that material, whatever the gas is that's inside the cylinder, as soon as it cools, it will return to the state that it was in prior to the explosion.
The question was about a blast in space, and I think you kind of answered it, but you're telling me if the blast goes off in space, it's the particles that's going to do the damage, nothing else, right?
Yeah, you're jumping to another subject. We're going to go there in a second, Barry. And John, you've exploded pyrotechnics, and I think you're saying you believe that once everything cools and the smoke settles, so to speak, the pressure inside of that sealed tank, assuming that it didn't rupture, is going to be identical to what it was before you exploded that chunk of dynamite. Is that sort of what you're saying, John? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. I agree with you, Dick. Only I thought there might be a slight increase in the pressure due to the expansion of the material itself. But that's the only way. Other than that, once that temperature goes down, I believe also it would return very close to the original pressure. But I've never been foolish enough to explode that type of stuff in a confined environment.
Yeah, I should have indicated which John I was talking to. KD2IXP, John, you've actually exploded dynamite. And give us some further words. Do you believe it would come back to the normal air pressure? Mr. IXP, K2LIW.
I used to work out in New Mexico at the Energetic Materials Research Center of the University of Mexico. And we blew up everything out there. You can possibly imagine. From simple things like ANFO to C4 and some really exotic things. We've tested buildings, we've tested containers, and if the container doesn't rupture after the explosion, when it returns, when the thermal equilibrium returns it to temperature, it's going to be the same pressure unless the container is disfigured and it changes its size. But if the container doesn't change its size, it's going to go back to the same pressure.
You're saying exactly what I speculated, John. And by way of the measurements you made out there in New Mexico, apparently that's confirmed. And to get to Barry's question, that nuclear device on the surface of the Earth, the majority of what it does is those extremely high energy neutrons come flying out of there, impacting the air molecules, heating up the air molecules. That creates extreme expansion, extreme temperature of the local air. That makes the shockwave. You explode a nuclear device in space, you're going to make some really potent Compton electrons, high power nuclear, neutrons are going to be flying out of there, but you're not going to see what you're used to seeing. You're not going to see the mushroom cloud. You're not going to see the shockwave. You're going to see an electromagnetic wave, an EMP, an electromagnetic wave where you might be 10 kilometers away, and the voltage that's induced into every piece of the wire of your electronics, of your aircraft or spacecraft, is probably going to be arc over most of your electronics. So the Faraday's law pickup of high velocity electrons hitting your wire are going to induce some extreme voltages in your wire. But the shock wave, you ain't going to see it. It's not going to look anywhere near like what you think it's going to do. And if you think that nuclear device is going to explode your comet or your asteroid, and therefore it's going to apply such a huge amount of force to it, it's going to steer it into some other direction so that it no longer hits the Earth, the amount of steering it does, you're going to be extremely disappointed as to how little it is, because an extremely small amount of mass is being pushed in that direction by the nuclear device. And will it fracture your comet or your asteroid and break it up?
Repeater, time out.
To continue along that line, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to pulverize your comet or asteroid into a zillion small pieces. You'd like to turn it into powder. So when it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it's inert. And you ain't going to get that. You might not even be able to fracture it. Yes, if you drilled a hole and you put the nuclear device down inside of the comet or the asteroid, I think you could do something very similar to what happens when you do a nuclear device underground.
Okay, you might be better off putting an engine on the comet. I think that's what they're trying now.
That takes you. Yeah, the engine sounds like the right way to go. I wonder if John, IXP, was also doing underground testing. KD2 IXP, K2IW in the TechNet.
Out in Socorro, New Mexico, at the Energetic Materials Research Center, we blew up everything in everything, underground, above ground. We built buildings and destroyed them every day. There's a wonderful crew out there that goes out and builds homes and business buildings. Standard, 18 inch on center, starts the whole nine yards. And we go out and blow them up just to see what happens. I have some really interesting film of some of those explosions, if you'd like to see them. Underground, the explosions are measured in two different ways. They're measured in what's called brisance and heave. The slower the burning of the explosive, like ANFO, like dynamite, the more heave, the more push it has. The casing that's used to breach steel and cut cable and things of that nature. So depending upon the brisance and the heave of the material you're using, that's going to make the difference.
If your explosion was far enough underground, even if it's a good fraction of a megaton nuclear device, if it's far enough underground, all you do is create a little bit of a cavity where that nuclear device used to be. You get a little bit of heave on the top of it. I've read the book by Mr. Foreman where he was doing this kind of testing. And at one time a mistake took place and he was on top of the device that was being exploded underground. And the earth under him did lift periodically and he came close to getting injured by that process. But once the smoke clears, so to speak, you fuse some local material and you end up with less volume underground than you started off with because you're fusing materials. I wonder if you've read stories along those lines, John. KD2IXP. And yes, if you're willing to mail me a couple of those movies or YouTube videos, whatever they are, I'd like seeing them. KD2IXP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'd like to see them also.
Dick, I believe... I do have the material, and I could email them to either of you gentlemen who are interested in it. That's not a problem to do that. You can see, for example, I have one where we put 15 pounds of C4 in a school bus, and you could actually see the ignition flow down the flash tube that's used to detonate the C4. I can do that. I can send that to you guys. As far as the underground goes, you'll get heave, and even something with a high brisance, if it's buried deep enough, you'll turn that brisance into heave, and what you'll end up getting is a void that will collapse on itself and not have, you know, the boom effect that people are expecting.
What's a bit amazing is that at one time, in the very early days of nuclear research, we thought that a nuclear device would be a handy way to create a pond, a lake, a harbor. You would just blast the earth out of the way. They used to believe that. And they also believed as a source of energy, it would be so economic that we would no longer put watt-hour meters on people's houses. Everybody would just simply pay a flat rate. They used to believe that. Well, we've become a lot smarter since then. You worked at that facility for what length of time, John? It sounds like exciting work. KD2IXP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I taught at the Energetic Materials Research Facility at the University in Socorro, New Mexico, for 7 years. When I retired from my prior occupation, like I said, you know, you can take something with a very high brisance, something that will crack steel and crack, you know, pulverized concrete, and if it's buried deep enough, or if it's buried properly, you're turning the brisance into heave because of what's surrounding it. And I believe that the gentleman with the question regarding the cylinder, I think that if the cylinder is strong enough, as he indicates, to not deform and to contain the explosion, he's going to turn brisance into heave, and he's not going to get, you know, the bang that he expects. And as soon as that material, as soon as the gases and the air inside the cylinder cool down, his pressure's back to normal.
Ain't that crazy? Very opposite of common sense. And so, explosions are different than you think. And if you've seen that PBS special, about La Bamba, I think it was called. In other words, the biggest nuclear device that has ever been exploded on planet Earth was roughly 50 megatons, done in Russia. And the man doing it was requested to build 100 megatons, and he decided to scale it back because he calculated that anything above 50 megatons is trying to go higher in the atmosphere, and it runs out of atmosphere. You don't get any extra bang for your dollar, if you know what I mean. You just break more windows nearby. And so there's a definite limit as to how far you can go. Anybody have any further questions on this crazy subject? Boy, sometimes the technique goes pretty far and wide. Go ahead, Wes.
It's an interesting subject. One thing that would be good to ask is if you have a tank and the tank is evacuated, but you have no pressure of the gases, and then you try to explode a certain amount of material there. But as far as the comet goes or the asteroid goes, it doesn't have to be nuclear bomb, the velocity. How much velocity you can give to the object that would be directed against the velocity of the comet. So I'm listening to your thoughts in this area.
Yeah, when it comes to steering that comet or that asteroid that in theory is going to impact the Earth, you'd like to do whatever corrective action you're going to do as soon as possible, because the longer you wait, the more energy that's required. Do it soon enough, it's a very gentle push. One of the best examples I worked on over the last few months was the fact that because of the interaction of the tides and the tidal friction and the moon's orbit around the Earth, the moon's orbit is expanding roughly 1.5 inches per year. Every year for the last zillion years, the moon moves out roughly 1.5 inches every year. The tidal force, the imbalance of the tidal friction and the tidal wave, so to speak, leads the moon, because the Earth is turning under the moon faster than the moon is rotating around the Earth. Okay, so if the Earth had no longer any tide, no longer any water, but you wanted the moon to move out 1.5 inches per year, and you're going to put an ionic engine on the right-hand side of the moon to push it to a higher velocity, higher altitude. So you've got this ionic engine that's now doing the exact same amount of force that the tidal imbalance is doing right now. How much force would that engine have to have? And it is a very large force. I can't remember the number right now. But that tidal imbalance is making an amount of force that you wouldn't believe. It's really, really huge. And a similar question you can ask people is that if you had an ideal gravity measuring machine, let me drop the call. And at high noon, you aim it at the sun and you measure the amount of solar gravity coming into your backyard. And then because it's a full moon at midnight the next night, at midnight you aim it toward the moon and measure the amount of lunar gravity in your backyard. You ask the person, which one of those measurements is bigger? Are we getting more solar gravity or lunar gravity? Boy, you can get in some deep arguments on that one. I'll give you one other hint. The difference is 150 to 1. And which one is larger will amaze the hell out of you. Have we run out of mailbag questions tonight, John? KC2WGB. We got a big bang out of the last one. K2REW in the tech man.
I think you didn't respond to my question.
Yes, Dick. The mailbag is complete, so you want whatever you want to do. But I wonder if Barry's still out there. I have a quick question for him. Barry?
I think you didn't respond to my question. My question was...
Wait a minute. Let me get a hold of Barry first, please, Wes.
N2 Moonbound, are you still there, Barry? K2REW in the group.
Yes, not Dick. Don't worry about it.
Okay, try again, Wes. The way you worded the question, I couldn't figure out what was being asked. Over to you, Wes.
You drew the picture that the nuclear device, or the bullet, or the rocket, is directed, let's say, to the asteroid. were the comet that is about to destroy the Earth. And I said, it is not that important how deep, how big is that nuclear device. Velocity factor, it could not even explode, depends from the side of that, body. You put this, give enough of velocity to that bullet of yours against the velocity vector of that asteroid. You know, it is serious damage without any explosion happening. And to hear.
Yeah, if you hit your asteroid or comet with a high velocity massive object, the medium good chance you're going to break it up into two or three pieces. And that's not enough. Theory, what I'm guessing would one of the best things you could do, assuming that the asteroid or comet is not rotating, that's another big factor. If it's not rotating, theory you could mount an ionic engine on its side and turn on that ionic engine for the next half year and let it slowly push that object into some other orbit that is more inert as far as the Earth is concerned. That, in my opinion, is going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar. But to put an explosive device nearby, I think you're going to be very disappointed. You're not going to get anywhere near as much reaction as you think you're going to get. And hitting it with a heavy, high-velocity object is going to have a little bit of push, nowhere near as much accumulated push as you're going to get from an ionic engine. And there's a chance you're going to break it up into pieces, and that's almost as bad as the original great big piece of US K2LIW. That's a bunch of opinions.
Into XGM. Well, I see it this way. Place you can have a pretty nice velocity for the object. Yes, the object may blow. You have rockets right now that are able to penetrate the bunkers, underground bunkers. So let's say it is a rigid device that is made to go against the vector or direction of the comet. Now, when those two collide, a few things happen. At first, both velocities are cancelled, but at the same time, the impact is stronger. And the second thing is, if the thing is about to break on three pieces, each mass of the pieces has a correspondingly slower, smaller gravity towards the direction, and the direction vector changes. That's what I see. So I'm not that pessimistic as you are in terms of this kind of ways to save the Earth. Is it? The important is how far is the object that you're trying to shoot. And to achieve
an object that would give us a lot of concern would be a couple of kilometers in diameter. It would have thousands of tons, maybe hundreds of thousands of tons of mass. Take one of our rockets at a high velocity and you hit that, you're spitting in the ocean. You're doing very little. Got a year of operation of an ionic engine continuously making thrust in one direction. Now you stand a chance of steering that thing. But that object with that much mass, you just impact it and you think you're going to move it. I think you're going to get very little motion out of that. That's my belief. I mean, you're hitting it with something that is 0.01% of its mass, 0.001%. Even though it's at high velocity, it's not going to have anywhere near as much Delta MV. That's what you're really looking for.
How big was the Tunguskan meteor?
I think it was kilometers in diameter. Go ahead.
If you analyze some of the craters, all the impacts that happened, doesn't have to be a peak, and its mass is going to only become smaller when it hits the atmosphere. Other than that, what I see is the velocity of each one of the pieces, if it breaks to the pieces, it will be a different direction. And also, if you hit a quite nice large body that is hitting our direction, the nuclear explosion would edge to change the vector of its course. So I'm not that pessimistic yet. Something has to give a direction to the body, and there is a certain curvature at which is this body is going. So changing it for 1 degree sometimes can be crucial to meet the Earth. To experience.
WS2N. Yeah, you turn it by 1 degree and do it 2 years ahead of time. You're home free. The time we go over to the space report, Paul, WS2N, I wonder if you've seen that very unusual star that Mike number two is bringing to our attention. WS2N with the space report. Space report number 184 of the series. K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
It's Mike's email. I clicked on it and I got 404 error. So I don't know what happened. We'll have to try that one again. I just wanted to talk about a couple of the events that have occurred in the last week. The biggest news, as far as I'm concerned, was actually today. You had the Jason 3 satellite launch to an 800 mile orbit, polar orbit, from Vandenberg Airport Base. And first of all, let me check my signal, Dick, back here.
The signal is quite good. In order to visit Mike's website, you have to recognize that it's more than one line as the address. You have to swipe that address and copy and paste it into your search engine. Otherwise, you only get the first line, which is not complete. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Oh, okay, yeah. I ran out of time when I was doing it, and I said I'll revisit this later. But, okay, yeah, I understand that. So this Jason 3 satellite was launched by SpaceX, and it was launched by one of their older versions. They have new Falcon 9 rockets that they built. They launched one last time from Florida and put up 11 satellites, and that booster came back and landed on Earth right back at Cape Canaveral successfully. Now they tried to do the same thing out west in California today, and the booster went up, and they planned on landing it on the autonomous barge. Just read the instructions, is the name of the barge that he gave it. So he had this thing stationed about 180 miles offshore, and rocket went up. The first stage separated successfully. The second stage put the Jason 3 satellite, and the booster was started to make its three burns that it has to make. It has to slow down, boost back a little bit, and then on the way down, reignite to slow it down further. And at the very end, right before it hits lands on the barge, it has to ignite the center engine only to try to land. Everything went as planned. It got to the barge, and it landed, but one of the legs, it has four legs, each leg is like 30 feet long. One of the legs did not lock properly, so it landed, soft landing, but then it fell over. But it didn't blow up, it didn't explode like a couple of the other tries that they tried to do in the Atlantic. So he came very close, and the last picture I saw, actually only one picture so far has been released, it's laying on the laying down on the barge. It only landed 1.3 meters off the center of the X that's on that barge. So that worked out pretty good. I'm sure they'll work on the legs, stiffen them up a little bit more. Each time it gets better and better at doing this, the idea is to get reusable rockets to come back, and you could drop the cost of launching these things, not by 10 times the amount, but he predicts eventually by 100 times the amount. So that was the main topic I wanted to cover. Last Friday, they had an EVA on the International Space Station. Tim Culper from the United States and Tim Peake from a little regulated, but it's as big as a suitcase, and they have to pull the old one out, put the new one in, out at the P6 location, all the way at the end, the last group of solar panels had failed back in November. So that was very successful. They did it very quickly, and they predicted they were going to do this like within an hour or two, and they did. But they usually do 6 or 7, sometimes 8 hour spacewalks. So this EVA was supposed to go just that long. They were going to route some data cables, some power cables, getting ready for the, they've done this a couple of times, by the way, in the past. It takes a lot of work to reroute these cables, and the idea is to set it up for the future docking and berthing of American spacecraft that are going to be going up to the space station in the not-too-distant future.
By the way, Paul, on that last EVA, was there some water leakage that took place in the helmet of the spacesuit? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I was just getting to that when I had keyed a lot of time out. In Tim Culper's spacesuit, there was water developing in his helmet, and they asked him to sample it. He said it was cold, and it was at the time when I heard it was it was 4 hours into the EVA, and it was about 2 inches long and about a half inch wide in front of his eyes. And after telling Mission Control that this was cold, they knew that the water most likely was leaking from his cooling system. You have tubes all going through your suit to cool your body. Depending on what we're doing here, and the idea is to compensate for the 500 degree change you're going to have between hot and cold when you're in space. So they predicted that was probably the leak. I haven't confirmed that yet. They're going to look into that, of course. So they decided to terminate the EVA, not abort. There's a difference between terminate and abort. Abort is drop everything and get back into the hatch. This was just terminate, slowly go back. The other fella, Tim Peake from European Space Agency, he had time to wrap up the cables. He wasn't going to continue on with his project and just leave. If it was at abort, it would, that's it. Just drop everything and let it hang, and we'll get it later. That wasn't the case. So they got it back inside. Scott Kelly was in charge of the egress and degress for the EVA, so he got a hold of Tim.
Repeater, timeout.
Tim Culper got his Culper was supposed to go on land. Have him going first, this way he would be, you can't switch positions when you're in the airlock on the Quest Lab. It's on a tight side, so this way he would be first into the main room of the Quest Lab, where Scott Kelly was there to greet him, pull his helmet off, and they had a syringe, and they ran they took some samples. It'll all be evaluated, and they'll try to figure out what the problem was. But they have to bring that up. Let me drop it.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about that, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. The other two things on my outline really was the Falcon 9 booster that came back on the 23rd of December successfully. They brought it out to Launch Complex 40, where they originally launched it in Cape Canaveral. And they fired up the rockets, all 9 rockets, to make sure everything was okay. They bolted down. It wasn't going to go anywhere. They just do a hot fire test, and they wanted to confirm that everything was okay. That went 100%. So it shows that these reusable rockets are a strong possibility for the not-too-distant future. Maybe even by the end of this year, they might even be able to salvage one and relaunch it. And the other thing is a pretty long topic, and that has to do with NASA contracts that they let out for three more contracts for resupplying the space station, and which will include, I'll go over it later, but which will include the Dream Chaser by Sierra Nevada, which I spoke about many times on the net. Questions about the EVA, Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, the water that leaked out of his cooling system, was that pure water? Was it potable? Is it something that he could drink without, didn't contain any antifreeze or whatever? That's one question. Second of all, I believe there was an earlier EVA some number of years ago where water started getting released inside of the spacesuit and the astronaut came close to drowning. When water is in front of your face and you're in the space shuttle itself, your hands can grab the walls, you can move away from it, you can grab the chunk of water, you can do all kinds of things. When you're inside of a spacesuit, you don't have a hand inside of that helmet. That water can go anywhere it wants to. And if it happens to go into your nostrils while you're taking an inhale, in theory it can start drowning you, or at least start choking you. I wonder if the astronauts have... Let me drop this.
And how many milliliters of water was it, Paul, if you know?
Yeah, I think he said it was 2 or 3 inches long and half an inch in diameter, the strand of water floating in his helmet. Paul's going to give us a repeat on that. But I wonder if the astronauts can go through a training program where if they swing themselves around in a certain way, holding on to things, and swing the whole spacesuit and them, in theory you can splash the water against the windshield, so to speak, and hopefully it'll stick there as opposed to floating freely in space and potentially drowning you. So I'd like to believe that even though the astronaut does not have a hand inside of that helmet where he can control where that water goes, I think there are some external techniques by which he might be able to control it. I mean, where the astronauts and the cosmonauts are able to swing their arms and hands in certain ways so that they can change the orientation of their body in free space without touching the walls. They have the ability to do that. By the same token, I think there's a maneuver they could practice that would give them some protection against drowning of water in the helmet. WS2N, K2LIW, with a bunch of opinions.
Okay, and John, the water doubled in size. By the time he got back to the Quest lab, through the hatch, it was up about 4 inches and about an inch wide, so it increased. That's the visible part. This happened back in 2013, was about 2.5 years ago, with Chris Hatfield. He was the EVA-1 because he was commander of the International Space Station at the time. He was the only Canadian commander so far. And his partner was Lou Palmiro from the EVA, from the ESA, from the European Space Agency. And Lou is the one that had the problem. Wound up with quite a bit of water in his helmet. And he couldn't see, and he had to practically feel his way back. That was an abort type of situation. And the reason he had so much water is there was no way to absorb it. Since that problem has occurred, they came up with these absorbing sponges inside the helmet on both sides, left and right, right around where your cheek is. In that area, they have these large sponges, and they tend to absorb any kind of moisture that's there. And Scott Kelly reported they were very swollen. So, you know, you're looking at probably, you know, there's probably water throughout his arms, his legs. And, you know, I'm going to be surprised if they came back with a half a liter of water or something, even more. So it becomes a situation that they know how to control now to some extent with these sponges. But if it's bad enough, you're going to get into that same kind of problem. So, again, it wasn't an abort. You know, it wasn't for those sponges absorbing water. I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they would have called an abort instead of the termination of the EVA. They've had other problems with problems with little drops of water. chemical, whatever chemicals are on the inside of your visor, when it was manufactured, that mixed with a little bit of moisture, and it wasn't a leak, it was just a little bit of moisture inside the helmet, and it happened to drip into this guy's eye. Well, they changed all that. That cleaning process doesn't exist anymore, so you don't get that film anymore. So time goes on. It's 50 years that they've been doing EBAs, and they make improvements all the time. Back to you, Dick.
The cooling lines that go across the astronaut's arms, legs, torso, and whatever are to cool and to properly control the temperature of his core. I think there are no cooling lines that go inside the helmet to his head. The blood flow from the rest of the body to the head is going to control that temperature of his head. As such, the water that's leaking out of those cooling lines is out below the helmet. Therefore, I would have considered putting a spongy device around his neck where the helmet joins the rest of the spacesuit. If the water always has to come from below, because that's where it's being used, up to the helmet, and if it's got to get by the spongy devices that are around his neck, filling up that airspace between his neck and the beginning of the helmet, maybe that could be stopped. Yeah, you got to worry about the breathing, the moisture in your breath collecting on the windshield, on the windshield of the spacesuit. So let me drop it. I think there's got to be a tube coming from the backpack, giving you the pure oxygen that's pouring into the helmet. And so that's going to go through the sponge. But you can see how I would do it. Rather than put a sponge to the left and the right side of his cheek, where he's now got to move his body in such a way so that the water hits the sponge and hopefully gets absorbed, I think you can stop the problem at the source by putting the sponge around his neck to fill up the airspace between his neck and the bottom of the helmet of the spacesuit. That's a guess. Who do you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW? Question? Here we are redesigning the spacesuit. We think we know. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I'd like to know if you've read anything, or Paul, if you've read anything about the Russian spacesuits. Are they experiencing this problem at all?
They have the, let me see if I have it. They have the Orlan spacesuits. They've had problems, not the exact same kind of problem. Other difficulties with their spacesuits. Heating and cooling systems have failed. They've had comm problems. It evolved over time. They're pretty good now. And they have the type setup where you remove the back and you pull your whole body inside of it, where the Americans have, you have a lower torso and an upper torso, and they connect like that. And they've changed. I think we're going to switch over to the Russian design when they eventually go to back to either Moon or Mars or future spaces. I think they're designing similar to what the Russians have, where you go through the back. But, they're reliable. Both suits are pretty good. The Americans have gone for spacewalks with the Russians in their spacesuit, and vice versa. So, got experience with both. I just wanted to mention these contracts that we're giving out for resupplying the space station. You have SpaceX again. They had CRS-1 that this goes up for a couple of more years. CRS-2 is the new group that's going to probably start in